Hello, fantastic friends, and greetings from the Atypical Behavior Analyst, your place in space to hear conversational information about the science of behavior analysis. I am your host, Kelly, and welcome to episode 50! Pew, 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 pew! Ah, yay, exciting things! Yeah, really, thanks, guys. We've made it this far, and that's really cool. And so before we jump into today's special-ish episode, let's go over some quick housekeeping. So first off, we're ACE approved. If you're listening for continuing education units, jot down the two keywords interspersed during the talk, and then take those over to our website, atypicalba.com, where you can purchase CEUs. Also, take some time to cruise around the site to see additional resources for each episode and more information about our phenomenal guests. Next, if you'd like to stay up to date with upcoming talks and live events, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Our lives are a fantastic time to hang out, learn, and interact directly with our guests, and our social media is a great way to get to know the podcast, so reach out and say, hello. You can also rate and provide feedback on your favorite listening platforms to help further our dissemination mission. And lastly, stick around after the talk to hear a preview clip from episode 51. And now, today's knowledge drops. So being an adult is difficult, and being an adult with disabilities is even harder, and being a caregiver can be overwhelming and discouraging and oftentimes leads to burnout. Many of these individuals and caregivers will be forced to navigate multiple systems, interact and adhere to professional recommendations and treatments, not to mention long learning and reinforcement histories that can lead to tangled webs of competing, interlocking, and overlapping contingencies. Disabilities are still misunderstood and surrounded by preconceived notions and biases. Families and caregiver dynamics are overlooked, and there's still too much talking and not enough listening to those in the thick of it. It may seem a compliment to label these caregivers as resilient, but the truth of the matter is they're tired, broken, and struggling. Resilience can be costly and can lead to disingenuous consent, placations, and a lack of adherence to treatment and intervention recommendations. It's tough to stay on top of things when the rest of the world is piling more things on. Working with adults presents its own unique challenges, but utilizing Gold Diamond's nonlinear analysis and the constructional approach can help bridge the gap between the frustrations and the unheard cries of these caregiving dynamics and provide beneficial, effective, and successful supports. So without further ado, we present episode 50, The Rest of the Story, Unpacking the Complexities of Supporting Adults with Disabilities, with me, Kelly, and special thanks to Hoosier Association of Behavior Analysis for allowing me to present at their annual state conference.
Hello, everybody. We're going to get started. I get the privilege to introduce Kelly Teat. She is a BCBA from Texas. She is working to support adult caregivers and systems utilizing Dr. Israel Gold Diamond's nonlinear contingency analysis and constructional approach. She's also the host for the podcast Atypical Behavior Analyst, where she gets to nerd out with a bunch of smart people and provide continuing education at the same time. So make sure you check that out. So welcome, Kelly.
All right, so we're trying cool stuff right now. And I'm super weird, and I have to be barefoot because that's how I'm comfortable. So I apologize if that freaks people out, but oh well, you're back there, don't worry. We're also trying subtitles, so this will be fun and interesting. I hope they help. It already spelled my last name wrong, but that's appropriate because that's just what happens with my name. So I'm Kelly. I'm kind of a weird, obscure human. I live in a weird space. If you read my bio, I am an INTP. On the Enneagram, I'm like a 5 with a wing of 4 and 8. If you're an animal, I'm not a beaver, I'm an otter. Let's see what else. I'm a military brat. I was a theater major for a little while. Actually thought I wanted to do that for a career, and then got into about 2 months and went, oh, this is a terrible decision. I am not ready for this. So now I host a podcast where I get to actually kind of channel that. So seeing real humans is very different because normally I am behind a screen. I've got my headphones on, and I legit for a sec thought I was going to put my headphones on up here just to keep myself in like a normal space. So I'm not, but that's part of the barefoot reason. So I've worked with adults for about 6 years total so far. And I'll get more into my history in a little bit, but I've really enjoyed the talks lately. And so bear with me because I've got a script, but again, theater kicks in and improv kind of kicks in, so we'll just kind of see how this goes. So one of the things that I've really enjoyed hearing is this focus on listening to people and getting to know them better and actually hearing what people are going through. And it's not just our clients. It's your employees, your supervisees, your friends, people you come in contact with. Those are all the people that need to be heard. And it's really tough. So we're going to go into kind of a different topic. So we've talked about resilience as a field. We've talked about resilience within companies. And I want to expand it out to, let's talk about the people that are actually there with our individuals 24/7, the ones that don't always get a break. So specifically, I'm going to be talking about parents, and we'll kind of get into that. But as a small disclaimer, I see the world through, I call them vectors, like the old anatomy books, where you could like pick it up and see like the skin, and then you could see like the blood vessels and everything. That's how my brain works. So I like to lay things on top of each other and just kind of look at it through a behavior analytic lens and see what happens. So bear with me. If I start getting super weird, raise your hand and say, I am not on track with you, and I'll try to bring us back. So I speak in metaphors, I speak in analogies. My love language is memes and GIFs. So I may reference a lot of movies or silly things like that. And my technical language is not great, because usually, again, I am on the listening end of things. I am not always on the speaking end. I like to hear other people tell their stories. So it's kind of a privilege to actually be able to share some good stories and some not so great to hear stories that I've heard and learned over the years. So. Whole time. Just so I have a general idea of y'all's lenses and vectors. That was very Texan. Wow. So let's start off with like, raise your hand, thumbs up, whatever, if you're working with like younger kiddos. So we're talking early intervention, early elementary school. Okay, très bien. All right, so now we're pushing, let's look at if you're working with like teenagers. Okay, about the same, Now in that transition stage, so teenager to early adulthood, where a lot of them are starting to kind of age out, okay? Oh, still actually a fair amount. Excellent. Bless all of you for working with teenagers and middle schoolers. They're not my favorite, not gonna lie. I tried, but I also know where my passions lie. So, and then what about, I love how I put old adults, so I have young adults and I have old adults. I'm feeling old, so that's what happened. So older adults, so we're talking like 20s and up. Oh, yep, that went down real fast. Okay, there's like seven of you. So it's different. So we'll get there. So we've got, most people are working with these younger, like the younger generations that are coming up. So now let's look at like, who are you training? So raise your hand. Are you training family members? Yeah, there we go. Cool. That's excellent. What about non-family members? So those of you training like direct care staff. Okay, good. Good. Nice balance there. Teachers, administration. All right. Good. So I've got a lot of training going on. So I like that balance. I do. So that gives me an idea of where you guys are at. So now here's kind of my background. Because again, context is important. So I want you guys to kind of see how I got to this point. So, and especially with Gold Diamond of how did we get here and where are we going to go going forward? So how I got here, like I said, I see the world through lenses and I needed to put these things in kind of context. So I started off my undergrad at UNT, University of North Texas. Yay! And I had the privilege of learning under Dr. Jesus Rosales-Ruiz. And during that time with Jesus, I was introduced to Israel Gold Diamond's constructional approach, the nonlinear contingency analysis, which now there is a beautiful book. If you have not purchased this book yet, I strongly recommend you do. It's lovely, but I really dug Gold Diamond because it made sense to me. Like, it expands the ABC analysis, and you start to see these patterns that form from in people's behaviors in different environments and in different settings and when different emotions happen, and you kind of tease it back to, oh, this thing happened. And as a person with mental health issues, I've done a lot of look at, like, antecedent triggers. And so seeing my clients experience certain things, I was like, okay, cool. This makes a little bit of sense. This is why people start to do kind of weird things sometimes. So Izzy's work focuses on contingency management, and it also incorporates these other variables like the environment, your emotions, these private covert events that sometimes we can be a little bit scared to talk about, but like we can make them, like we can define them. We can have them be observable and measurable, and we'll get there. So again, I like patterns, and our lab worked with college students. At the time. So we were working with individuals who were on academic suspension or on academic probation. But before we could actually even work with them, Jesus made us go through and we had to take our own data on ourselves. So we had to fill out our logs, and I'll talk about the logs a little bit later. And you kind of started to learn like, oh snap, man, when I go to this class, I am super stressed out. What is it about this class? And you start to kind of pull apart those layers and go, oh, well, you know, either the assignment wasn't great, or maybe I just don't like the professor, or in some of the individuals that we worked with, they were just in the wrong major entirely. They thought they needed to be in this major. And for example, one of the gentlemen was, he really wanted to own an archery clinic. Like, that was his goal. And so he became a business major, because that's what you do. You want to own a business, you get a business major, ta-da. And he was failing, and he was miserable. And so what we ended up doing was kind of teasing apart, well, what do you need to do to own an archery clinic? We need to have a building. Do you need to have this degree? No, what else can we do instead? And so you find out what these goals are, and you build from there. So, yeah, we'll go more into that. But one of the joys of being able to do those logs was it's a skill that I've been able to take with me, and I've been able to use in my personal life and in my professional life, so both with myself and also with my clients. And then I got into grad school, and I had a class with Dr. Shala Alai, and she's wonderful, and she, I think, was actually my very first class in grad school. And we read Waller's Insular Mother, her problems in the parent-child treatment, and it's a little bit older, but I still find the data to be really valid in it. And so what they found was that these women, and again, this is the 1980s, so take into context that, so definitely I'll just say caregiver. So a caregiver only has certain environments, and they're dealing with a child who has a disability. And so we have to go to the doctor, we have to go to the psychiatrist, we have to go see this person, and then maybe we go see family. And what they found was, like, all of these environments that these people were coming in contact with were constantly full of demands or advice or recommendations. Oh, why don't you do this with your kid? Why don't you do this? Or if you're, you know, in a professional stance, what do? We come in and say, hey, here's this beautiful treatment plan. We'd love for you to follow it, da-da-da-da. And they go home and go, I'm exhausted. I can't do this. And so that's where we start to see this fall apart of following through with treatment plans. So that was an amazing thing. So again, another little layer there. And then to be vulnerable with you guys, the last year has really sucked. I have a passion for mental health because I grew up in an environment, like I said, I was a military brat. I'm also an only child. And I grew up in an environment that did not cultivate discussion about mental health. So it was, oh, I'm sorry you feel that way. Why don't you just pray about it more? Or why don't you just, you know, you shouldn't feel that way. Well, damn it, I do. So what are we going to do about it? So it's part of the joys that I have now is like being able to kind of push for more mental health. And I love the fact that we're able to have these spaces to have these kind of discussions and it be not as uncomfortable as it used to be. So in the last year, I lost a client that I absolutely adored. I learned a lot from them. They were deaf-blind. They had been married for 30 years. Their partner was their translator-interpreter. And I learned so much. And then they died. And I was like, well, that sucks. So I had a moment. And thankfully, I was seeing a therapist, so we had a moment. And then my dog died. And my dog had been with me for 13 and a half years. I lost friends to suicide and other ailments. So it was great. I mean, I was getting to this point of just like, I don't know what to do anymore. So we go back to the beginning kind of deal. And then this keeps going, because like I said, it was a rough year. My grandfather died. He had dementia, and he was in his 80s, and my mother is the oldest child out of two, and we're closest, and so I had to watch her struggle with him. And she would call me, hey, he's getting angry at the staff. I don't know what to do, and I could hear it in her voice how emotional she was. And she'd tell me, put your BCBA hat on. Okay, cool. So I drop down. I'm not the daughter now. I'm the BCBA. Here's what I need you to remember. He has dementia. He's going to say something. And he's going to forget it 2 seconds later. Like, remind the staff of these things. So having these conversations about what these adults are doing and what they're going through and trying to have other people understand that is really where I started to hone in. So career-wise, like I said, I've worked with adults now for about 6 years. I've been in multiple capacities. I've played around in the SSL. In Texas, we have State Supported Living Centers still. They're delightful. There's 13 of them in the entire state, ranging anywhere from, I think the smallest population is like 90, and the largest is like, I think, 1,100. And these are individuals who, this is considered the most intensive form of care. They stay there, they eat there, they live there, they quote unquote work there. That's it. And so that was very eye-opening. And then I've kind of branched out now into working more with like group homes and in day hab facilities. And then specifically for this talk, I wanted to focus in on parents. I work with parents. And I'm getting older. My parents are getting older. I'm looking, I work with adults that are my age. and I work with adults that are older than me. And so their parents are in their 60s and their 70s. And it's tough because life is really, really different when you're an adult. Like working with kids, super fun. I dig it. But working with adults is really tough. So I've heard a lot of stories. I've heard a lot of traumatic events that have happened. I've read things that have just, it's heartbreaking. And especially when you can see the contingency happen and you see the patterns and the behaviors flow and you're like, hey, this event happened when they were younger and it was never dealt with because they had a disability. So a lot of times it's like, well, I have a disability, so therefore they can't think that way or they don't have those emotions, which is a bunch of BS. So I started to see how not taking care of these things was impacting these individuals' lives and then overarching how it impacted their parents' lives as well. So our caregivers hold a valuable role in society. And when we narrow it down, they really are what's imperative to keeping those treatment plans going. So if we want to make change, we have to make sure that, you know, our programs are being followed to fidelity and all those great things. But things fall apart. And especially because, I mean, it's the real world. Like, I love clinic. It was great. And it was clean. But then I got into the real world and I was like, oh, snap, man, this is not. There's so many other variables you have to take into consideration. And so, unfortunately, being a caregiver is not always reinforcing. You're under multiple stressors. You know, my mom is taking care of her aging father, and she's also dealing with my dad, who's just retired, and so he's home all the time. And then she has to deal with me on top of it, and she's also got all of her other things. So there's all these multiple things that you have to take into consideration because it takes up your time and energy. And so, again, today's focus, talking about caregivers. So real basic, I'm really focusing in on family members. I would love to have another talk about direct care staff, especially from the perspective of having RBTs versus, like, and what I'm familiar with, state employees, who, you know, there are individuals who need a job and oftentimes don't have the education and the training to come with it. So, but family members I wanted to hone in on because the motivation is very, very different because they're family. And depending on the family dynamics and the culture, like, you don't leave your family. You can't. Like, you don't just stick them in a home. Like, that's what we used to do. And we quickly learned that was not a good choice. So we've switched it over now. But they don't get to leave. So, like, direct care staff, they get to take a break. They get to go home, live these other lives, have other reinforcing environments and other behaviors. Whereas these parents are stuck. And there's a lot of stigma that comes with somebody who's trying to, you know, take a break. I mean, they're told, again, we go back to the insular mother. Oh my gosh, you're so stressed out. You just need to take a break. Okay, cool. Well, like, can you watch my adult 30-year-old son who can't communicate verbally and uses pictures? Can you take care of him for the weekend so I can go take a break? Oh yeah, no, I'm. That's really tough. I can't do that. Cool, man. Now I've got some competing contingencies here because, like, you told me to go take a break, but no one's helping. Okay. So it's conflicting, and it was tough. I had, over the pandemic, I had conversations with parents about, we don't know who's going to make it through. I've had situations where the caregiver is already pushing 70, and they're taking care of their aging parent along with their adult child who has severe disabilities and is aggressive and is self-injurious. And then there were dogs that were old and dying. And so, I mean, it was one of those moments of, like, I was waiting for a call at any given point of someone just not okay, not making it. Sadly, the dogs didn't make it, but the humans did, so we're good. But it was, again, that kind of, like, gut moment of, oh, shit, this is real life. You know, these are people that are hurting. So we all need to take a break, and we all need time to recharge. And it's important, so health is important. So some of the considerations when you're working with adults, and again, because I see this in layers, this is going to apply both to the actual adults that I work with and also to their caregivers. So because they're also adults. So, I mean, just the changes that you get. Like, again, I loved working with kids and it was super reinforcing because their learning histories are super short or shorter. So changing or putting in replacement behaviors or, you know, alternative behaviors was a little bit easier. Because, again, you don't have these long histories. It's really reinforcing because their skill acquisition is pretty quick. Like, kids are kind of like sponges. And so it's fun. They learn. They still like to play with toys. I think that's freaking awesome. Like, heck yeah, man, let's go, you know, play and learn through that. But adults are different because all of these things are now expanded. So just keep doing this apparently. So it's one of those, you have to look at, you know, what was actually their education skills and so, or their educational background. And for a lot of the ones that I'm working with, they grew up in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And we didn't have great programs for special education at those times. They're still developing now, but it's one of those, we had to take that into consideration. I've had clients that were put into a medically fragile unit because they didn't know where else to put them. And they were by no means medically fragile. And so we have these lacking repertoires, these prerequisite skills that aren't there just because of the environments that they grew up in. And those things we have to consider. Similar things like social and leisure skills. You know, if we're not, a lot of our people, you know, we can fixate, and that's super cool, and I get it. But, like, we have to keep bringing things up, and we have to keep giving these options to explore. And as you get older, those opportunities just start to narrow down more and more. I see it a lot with education, especially that transition, because when someone's in school, they at least have teachers. They might have an OT or a speech or PT that comes in and helps out periodically. While they may not get invited to the birthday party, at least there may be a potential to get invited to a birthday party later. Like, you can go to Chuck E. Cheese on an off day. There's a lot of sensory-friendly activities for kids. I don't see a lot for adults. Usually it caps out at like, oh, we'll have adults to 25. And I'm like, cool. People still live past 25, y'all. Like, shocking. Sometimes. So, but, you know, we have to take this in consideration of, like, what are the options that are available? Taking into consideration trauma, things like that, you know, it's, even if the person can't tact and they can't label what it was that they went through, it's still there. Your brain's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. I strongly suggest, if you haven't ever checked out Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score, definitely check it out. It's a beautiful discussion about how your brain kind of rewires based on trauma, and then also how your coping skills can develop from that. So it's things that we can't ignore, but even though they're private, so anyway. Other things like medical, physiological changes, and then the big one that I see, again, are these resources. So again, in school, resources are not plentiful, but there's more of them. And then you become an adult, and it all gets yanked out from underneath you. In Texas, it's like, cool, man, you have till 21, 23, depending on when you know, when your birthday is, and then good luck. Have fun. Here's a terrible website for you to go look at to see if you can figure out your services. And it's not okay. It's really not. So again, and so one of the other ones that I'll kind of hone on are like the time and energy and space. So the space is considering, you know, those opportunities to go out and do things. A lot of my people will go out at like 6 a.m. or 10 p.m. when no one else is there. You know, they schedule those times because heaven forbid, you know, something happened. And they live in this fear, and that fear is totally rational. That's one of the big things that I love from Gold Diamond is all behavior is rational. It makes sense. We just have to be detectives and kind of explore and see what else is out there. So, like I said, I had a script, but started improvising. So, we're like 6 slides in, and we're finally getting to resilience because that's just how I roll. So we've got several layers. Again, hope y'all are tracking with me. No one's raised their hand yet, so that's good. So resilience by definition, because I did the quick Google search because that's what we all do, and when I can't figure something out, that's my go-to. So it's the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties, it's toughness, and the ability of a substance or object to spring back into shape, elasticity. I am an experiential learner. And so I am one of those that had rubber bands constantly and would just sit here and pull, and then how it snapped me in the face or in the hand. And it's like, well, that's dumb. But if we start to kind of think about that in terms of these caregivers that we're working with, they're like the rubber bands, and they're getting pulled in multiple directions, medical appointments. Oh, by the way, when you get older, your body falls apart. And so it's not just going to your PCP anymore. Now it's like you've got to go to the enterologist, the gastro, you've got to go check out the brain, you've got to go check out the heart. And so it's trying to schedule all these multiple appointments. Okay. And then it's, but I still have to get the dishes done and I still have to get the house cleaned up because a lot of the parents are moms or dads and they're single parents sometimes. And who else is going to do it? It's still them. You know, it's only them. And so they're the ones that are getting just stretched. And so when they snap, I mean, and it's going to happen at some point. you know, one of the snaps that I heard was, I'm glad that I don't have a garage because I'm pretty sure I would just put all three of us in there and close the door and turn the car on. And I, again, that was one of those, oh shit moments. Like, okay, cool. This is not in my scope. What do I do? Because if this parent goes down, it's all going down. So I really had to start thinking about what do we need to do? What can I do to help these people start to realize that there's still a little bit of hope? Because, I mean, the last 3 years have been chaotic for most people, almost 3 years. So I actually quite enjoyed 2020. It was my last year with my dog. I didn't have to drive. I was in therapy. It was great. Everybody else seems terrible. And I get that. And so trying to see those little glimpses, and that's really where I started to look at caregiver health. So I love The Princess Bride. It is my absolute number one favorite movie. And even though Count Rugen is a total villain and Humperdinck is also a total villain, this quote sticks with me. And if you cannot read it, because it's very small, it says, get some rest. Because if you haven't got your health, you haven't got anything. And again, it's true. If you're not healthy, if the environment isn't healthy, you can't do behavior analysis. You can't go in and have treatment. Like, you can't go in and expect a program to be followed through with fidelity if the person is suffering, if they're struggling and battling these competing contingencies of time and resources. And kind of this overarching theme that I've been hearing in the last couple of talks is being heard and being acknowledged. Because so often they go in and they say, I'm tired. And okay, but no one listens. The doctor just says, oh, okay, well, here's this script. You know, we're going to have you go do this and go see this person. Okay, I guess I'll add that to my schedule. I don't know when. And they're like, well, that's not my problem. No, it kind of should be, in my mind at least. So the caregiver health is so important. And it's not just that physical, it's the mental and the emotional. So I've had a lot of people cry on me, and it's really uncomfortable when that happens because I am not an emotional person. What you guys said earlier, total moment of vulnerability. I appreciate you guys letting me have that. But it's really tough to have, you know, someone just kind of break down. And oftentimes, you know, our response is to kind of like, okay, cool. I'm not a therapist. I mean, I have to write that on my paper because that's how people recognize me because they don't know what a BCBA is. But like, yeah, no, I'm not a counselor. So what do we do with that? Well, that's why I like the constructional approach. So, again, we're kind of overlaying a lot of things. And when the parent is struggling, when they're emotional, when they have these, you know, extinction bursts, if you will, of anger or frustration, you know, our response should be to ask more questions, should be to listen and not just give advice like Waller was talking about. So it's building this rapport and making sure that they feel comfortable in a space to share with you what's going on so that way their health stays.
If you are listening for continuing education units, here is the first of your two key words. Your first word is stories, S-T-O-R-I-E-S. Listen to your clients' stories.
So I went down a couple of rabbit holes because, again, I have to have multiple layers of things. It's fine. So I decided to look at the hierarchy of needs. And fun fact, Maslow's hierarchy of needs that we're all very familiar with, really no one knows where that came from. It's fascinating. Yeah, that whole like original pyramid. And so there's been a lot of discussion on revamping it because it's done from a very Western-centric way of thinking. And so the new one that I found, and I totally forgot to put the link on here, so if you email me, I can totally send it to you. The one that I found was discussing on these three levels now. So we get rid of like the six levels that were there. And I like this because I'm hoping you guys see how it overlays with what I've talked a little bit about with Waller and Izzy. And so the new hierarchy talks about autonomy of choices. And for me, I kind of looked at it as like your degrees of freedom. So how much autonomy are these parents getting when they go into the doctor's office or they go into talk to a case manager to see if they have enough funds to, you know, get their child the support that they need? Do they have an option to say no? And a lot of times that option it's really not there. It's forced. It's non-genuine compliance. It's apathy. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years. Nothing has changed in 20 years. Why would I expect it to change now? I like to think that we can make changes. So another one is having that relatedness. And this goes into having multiple environments that are reinforcing. One of the key takeaways that Jesus taught me when I was in school was I have to have three environments, at least three environments, my friend. One for work, one for play, and then one that's like your house. So it's you have to have multiples. You have to have things that are reinforcing to balance out the things that are aversive. And a lot of times our caregivers, the only environments they have are demands, aversive. You know, I don't, especially during the pandemic, no, you can't leave your house. Like you were stuck there. And if your child started, you know, again, this adult child started to act out, where are you going to go? And if you call somebody, are they also in just a state of distress that you guys, while you're both talking, no one's really hearing because no one has the energy to give to that other person. So a lot of times we kind of fall into that role. We become the only reinforcing entity sometimes for some of these parents because we're the only adult that comes in and hopefully doesn't just dictate what they should do. And I have been guilty in the past of trying to do those things, of going in and saying, well, you know, if you followed my program to fidelity, you know, you'd probably be better off. But now I question, well, why are we not? Why are we not following through? What was making it difficult? And breaking that part down. Because a lot of times it's, again, resources or time or just frustration. And sometimes they just need to vent and they can tell you what the issue was. Yeah, I totally didn't follow through because I was angry about X, Y, and Z and I was already on the edge and so I snapped. All right, cool, man. That makes sense. Again, behavior is rational. So, third part of it, sorry, I almost jumped far ahead. So the third part of it is competency. So we consider, does the person actually have those skills? Because again, these are adults. And so we just assume that, you know, parents, you know, obviously you guys have a manual when you have kids, right? So like you get a manual and you're able to do all of these things. You totally understand your child's disability, their diagnosis, the changes that are going on within them. And unfortunately, that's not really true. So most of the time, you know, we need to go and look and see, you know, are we missing something? Is there something there that we can teach? Whether it be learning more about training or teaching, or is it, do we need to talk more about the disability and have some more questions, you know, answered there? Do they have the resources to even, or do they have the ability to even navigate to get to those resources? Again, I come from Texas where it's not easy to find your resources. You know, there's a couple of different websites that you go through and sometimes they match and sometimes they don't. And so it's frustrating. And the caregivers just eventually get to a point where they're like, it's fine, whatever you tell me, I'll do it. And then, but they don't do it. And then people get mad and this little cycle continues and it's like, well, okay. So I'm tired of that. I really am. I'm tired of my people hurting and my family's not doing okay. Because it's not. Like, again, I come from a place of, like, mental health is so important. Physical health is so important. And if you don't have that, I mean, you don't have anything. So, again, kind of overlaying that hierarchy of needs then with Gold, Diamond, and Waller. So the way that I saw it was Waller especially looked at those environments. So are the environments they're coming in contact with actually reinforcing, or are they just demands? And Izzy talks about that too. You know, you've got to have multiple environments. You have, and seeing how you respond emotionally in those, because again, they may assume that they're enjoying it, but you're kind of watching and you're watching their body language and you're hearing the way they're talking about it. And it's like, I don't really feel like you like that. Like maybe the doctor isn't the best doctor. You always sound really concerned when you come back. And so we're able to start kind of labeling those things. Another part that I saw that was overlaid was looking at kind of like what's optimal. So if everything does go right for the day, for the hour, what's going on? And then focusing on those values and the motivation of people while still looking at observable behaviors and routines. So again, we're scientists. We're behavior analysts. If we can measure it, we can observe it. It's cool. So that's why I really dug the constructional approach. So these are the bottom picture is my absolute favorite picture of Izzy. That is his fishing hat. And if you don't know the history of Gold Diamond, let me give you a quick one. So Israel Gold Diamond was in like the 1960s, and he was a psychologist? Anyway, he had outpatient treatment and was working with his patients, and then he ended up getting into a car wreck and became paralyzed from the waist down. So in that picture, he's actually sitting in his wheelchair. And if I remember correctly, they went racing down the hill after this. So while he was a patient, he's sitting there and he's realizing, this is what my patients go through. And so it's that perspective taking. Can you take yourself out of what you're doing and see what that other person is going through? And so, like I said, the last year of watching my mom go through this and then watching the parents that I've worked with for several years go through these pain and struggles, it's like, oh shit, I mean, it's real. And so one of the joys of having a theater background is it's something that I'm kind of good at, is being able to put myself into a role. But not a lot of people are, and that's fine. It's a skill that you can learn. Anyway, so Izzy started thinking about this and has several great papers on it, one being Inside Outsider and things like that. And it's, again, if we're professionals, we need to consider the people that we're working with. So the constructional approach, in a very quick nutshell, is looking at the terminal repertoire. So where do you want to go? So I told you guys like where I started. And where I want to go is I want the caregivers, the parents that I work with, to feel like they're accepted, to feel like their adult child is accepted, that their voices are heard, that there's a community for them that digs them and that is appropriate for them and reinforcing. And then what is optimal? And this is a fun one because the actual question that Izzy asks is, so aliens have taken over the world during the night. Hello. That's great. That's hence the reason we have a little magpie alien as our mascot. And everyone is assigned their own alien. That's kind of cool. And this little dude is going to follow you around, or big dude, however you want to picture him, is going to follow you around, and he's just going to observe you. What does he see if your day goes well? And this gets rid of the whole, oh, I felt good. Well, what does that mean? This really focuses in on, tell me what you're seeing, what's actually happening. Oh, well, you know, my child gets up and comes downstairs, we take meds, we have breakfast, and then, you know, things go smoothly. Okay, what else does that mean? Well, there's no, you know, challenging behavior, there's no aggression. Ah, cool. So if there's not this, then what? Well, they're sitting at the table, you know, maybe we're having a meal together, we're actually able to all of us sit down, because that's a big thing, because a lot of times it's mom eats, she may throw something in the fridge for dad or siblings, and this person, you know, has asked for dinner at 2 p.m., so we're going to have dinner at 2 p.m. because I'd rather do that than have a meltdown. Cool. Again, these are all things that make sense. So, but you start to build on that. And the cool thing is, as you're asking these questions, you get these natural answers of what people's values are and what their motivation is. So, do they just want to have a nice dinner? Like, is family time important to them? Is going out in the community important to them? Or both those things. So you start to kind of learn through a more fun way of doing it. Instead of going, so what's your goals? You know, that's boring. Talk about aliens. More fun. So other things that the constructional approach does is that we are looking at what the current repertoires are. So there's not reduction in skills. Like, this is one of the cool things. We've actually created our behavior support plans for our company to be constructional. So we don't focus on behavior reduction. We focus on, these are the skills we're going to be teaching. Here's why. I mean, because we want to get rid of these. But we're replacing, or we're providing alternate behaviors. And we start with things that they can already do, even if it's minutia, even if it's super small, and then we move from there. And so we build and we shape. And it can be difficult. Because there's a lot of question asking and everything, but it's a lot more reinforcing than just getting rid of all the things. When you start seeing new behaviors happen, if you get like behavioral cusps, so you teach a skill that provides them access to new reinforcing environments, like that's super cool. And those procedures, so we're getting the procedures for change, which is that construction of your repertoires. So we're either building something new, we're building up, we're putting it in new places. Jesus would say, you know, slap a contingency on it. So if this behavior is happening and you don't really know what's going on, put a contingency on it. See what happens. And the big thing is moving away from contrived reinforcers to the more natural reinforcers. So what those critical consequences are. So again, for the parents, they, you know, it may be the impression of, well, I just want them to have a good life. You know, I want them to be accepted. Okay, well, let's go a little bit deeper with that. What does that actually look like? What are those critical consequences? Well, I want them to be able to go to dayhab and at least hang out with peers without, you know, getting upset or, you know, things like that. Maybe participate in an activity. And so we start to really hit those moments of, ah, okay, that's what we're looking for. Not just, you know, going, you know, it's all these little behaviors. And so the monitoring logs are really where the fun stuff happens. And they're fun. You can modify the tar out of them. I mean, I've put them in where I have already essentially filled it in with the common environments that they're in. So that way it's just a checkbox. We can shape that too. I mean, the joy is behavior analysis, man. We shape everything. We can shape behaviors. We can shape repertoires. And the goal is to teach that person to become their own contingency analyst. So I'm going to work myself out of a job, hopefully. Like, my favorite thing is when someone calls me, like I'm on a consult and they're like, okay, so, you know, Bill totally did this the other day. And then I heard you in my head. And I was like, yes. Parent threatened once to buy like the WWJD bracelets, but put KD on it. And I was like, that's kind of sacrilege, but okay. Whatever makes you think, like, you know, if it's me, that's fine. I mean, it shouldn't just be me, but like, whatever. What I want them to do is I want them to be able to recognize those critical variables that are happening in their environment and go, aha. Normally what I would do would be this, and those that behavior or that response led to these consequences that I sure wasn't a fan of. Whereas now, if I take that step back, there's a lot of discussion about that pause between a stimulus and a response, that pause right there. That's what I want them to kind of get to. That pause to go, where do I want to go from here? They're acting out. I wanted to finish my grocery shopping. Is this going to be feasible? You know what? If you leave the freaking cart there, it's okay. You can come back. Or, you know, like, this is my very dark moment of like, or if the world ends tomorrow, it doesn't matter anyway. So, you know, it's giving people permission to kind of feel those things. So again, becoming their own contingency analyst and being able to recognize what their responses are doing in the grand scheme of things. So here's how I've applied it. So I really have tried to shut up and listen, you know, to do the opposite of Hamilton instead of, you know, talk less, smile more, whatever. Smile, anyway. So talk less, listen more. I wait. I sit through uncomfortable pauses. It's not fun. I mean, it's very uncomfortable for me. I appreciate when it's done on Zoom because I can sit there in my house and I can go through all my coping techniques and everything. But at the same time, like, if I'm present, so long as I'm present, and that's the big thing, it's presence. Am I actually listening? So that's why I specifically have on there, my computer is down. Like, I go in and I have clients, particularly the client, that does not like my computer. And so I've learned I don't need to have my computer. And especially if the parent just needs to have a moment to talk, cool. Let's just have a moment to talk. Again, that's okay. Even if, you know, we're also under pressures of like, I have to bill for this. I need to do this. I need to make sure that I'm following and I'm staying in my scope. Cool. We can stay in our scope and still listen to people and still hear what they're going through and be able to give them, I don't want to say direction, but if nothing else, just a guidance. And again, a lot of times, as people are talking, they know what the answers are. I think we've all kind of been there in that respect. So I sit through, I ask about the good things. What went well? What are we going to do again? Cool. Do we want to keep this going? Awesome. Excellent. And then we ask about the bad things, and we talk about that, and we problem solve. Cool. Why didn't this work? Again, all of these other pressures that are coming in on caregivers, we can start to tease apart. It's not just, I didn't follow your program. Okay, cool. Well, tell me why. And be honest. Well, it's really difficult. Awesome. What makes it difficult? Well, I don't like having to fill in dot, 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 dot. Cool. Can I make this easier for you? Can I narrow it down? You know, can I partially fill it in so all you do is check boxes? Awesome. Or maybe it's, I didn't follow it this week because everybody got sick and just not going to compete with that. Cool. I get it. Yeah. It's, you know, we're human. We all have emotions. We all have feelings and sensations and everything like that. And so hearing people and understanding that other people are going through shit just as much as we are is important. And I've heard from a couple of our guests on the show, which has been really fun. Stories are data points, man. Like, listen to the stories. Listen to, even if you've heard them before, it's obviously important to that parent. There's something in that information and that story that is important to them, and that's why they're holding on to it and sharing it with you. And then, cool, what do we do with that? You know, sometimes we don't need to do anything with it, but sometimes we can start looking through and going, okay, that's competing with you following here. Or in the case of my one family who I was, you know, glad they didn't have a garage, you know, I have a background in counseling. It's one of my minors, but I am not a counselor. I didn't want to go, they had a heck of a lot more hours you had to go through. So many more hours. It was like 3,600. Yeah, I was not going to do that. But I can channel some of those techniques, you know, positioning, things like that. Again, computer down, I'm facing the person, I'm oriented. I paraphrase and summarize a lot of things because I'm trying to pull out, making sure that I'm matching what they're telling me. And if I'm inaccurate and I don't check in, well, I'm just bored to the whole thing. So I check in with them and we move forward. So it's a lot of building up this rapport and trust. And really finding those little things to reinforce. Because again, even if they come to you and say, yep, everything went to pot and I did nothing this week. Everything's terrible. It's all on fire. Hey, guess what? You're still alive. Cool, man. So kind of like with going back to the client, so this poor caregiver and again, staying within my scope, what can I do? Well, I can recommend other environments, but also, so we talk about that. Hey, what are some options that are out there? Well, you know, I'm terrified to leave the house, which is a very valid statement, because you have medically fragile humans that if you come in contact with, you know, highly infectious disease, you can take down both of them. Okay, cool. So that's not an option right now. What are some other options? Well, and I'm not the one providing this. I'm just kind of asking, you know, what else could we do? Because I want to teach them that problem solving skill. I want to teach them to be their own contingency analyst. When these things happen, what are the options that I have in this situation? And go from there. So in this case, it was, maybe you should call your psychiatrist, you know, it's okay. Call them. And if they don't answer, call them again. And if they don't answer, find a new one, you know, because again, you want to be heard. So we can stay within our scope while still working through these really difficult, complex situations, and make sure that people are staying healthy and that they're, because again, if the environment isn't healthy, if the person's not healthy, then they're not going to follow through with programming and it's not their fault. It's not. Like, there's no blame. Behavior, again, behavior is rational. We just have to figure out how to shift things to where they're going to be successful. So we start small. You know, I've done things where it's like, cool, I just want you to try it one day this week. Just give me one day. And then, cool, we get through the one day. And then maybe it's two. And then we fall back. And it's none. And then we jump forward. But it's always, I'm always going to try to reinforce something because we're so often the only other person that comes in contact with them that's not just demanding. They get a little bit more of our time because, at least in my position, I may have 2 hours a week with somebody, and I spend a majority of that going, do we have data? Okay, cool. Nifty, let's do a quick review, debrief if we need to, maybe some quick one-on-one over here. But a lot of it is I'm talking with the parent because they're there 24/7, to bring it all back to that. So I need to make sure that they're going to be okay in things. And that's why we teach contingency analysis. So some of my recommendations, you know, if you're working with kids, awesome, keep working with kids, but please consider, you know, if you're not already considering what the parents are going through, because this is not, you know, selective to just adult parents. Like, parents of kiddos are still going through really crappy times too. You know, the world is still really difficult. So consider hosting events that are all inclusive, regardless of age. And also think too about how you're promoting it. Because oftentimes I see like, hey, we're having this event and everybody on that poster is under the age of 6. And so these parents go, yeah, we're not invited. We're not included. And again, that's not okay. Like, we can set up these environments. We can help you be successful. Providing common areas that are safe to really improve visibility. So this comes back to like my mental health thing and like why I talk about it. Because the more visible it becomes, the less scared other people are of it. And this is something that I hear too. People are afraid of my kid. God, that's disheartening. Like, I mean, I'll give. Adults, we're not always cute. And we can do some really gross things. And with, you know, no F's given on it. And going into public can be really difficult, you know. Go, and so we used to tell people, you know, go find the nearest Big Lot, or not nearest, go find a faraway Big Lots, because no one judges you at Big Lots, or Walmart. you wear a badge though, or at least something that designates, otherwise they look funny. But, you know, we would tell them, go to these other places so no one knows you. I remember, and now I go, nope, no, I don't want to do that. Why? Because I want the rest of society to know what these individuals and families have to go through. Because until you see it, you don't get it. And that's really, and it's tough. I mean, we've hidden people with disabilities away for years and are just now kind of slowly starting to bring it back out. But it's, you look at representation, a lot of it's like cute. Like, look at the guy at Starbucks. Look at the guy that owns a restaurant. Yeah, my guy sure is not going to do that. But you know what? He can tell me that he doesn't like me or he's ready for me to go. But he'll also hang out with me too and give me a little fist bump. Like, so there's really cool things that happen in these families, but it's scary to the rest of the world. So thinking about improving that visibility for these adults, and I'm even thinking, dreaming big here on this, guys, of like not just going in and teaching a dayhab staff, you know, a gym. Because again, what are the environments that the rest of us get to go into? I can go to the gym at any time I want. I can go to the gas station. If I have to go get my car fixed, I can go take my car to get fixed. What do they do when their car breaks down? They are stuck because maybe I could call a family member and they can take my car, but oh man, we've got medical appointments, so we're going to have to get an Uber, and like I can't get this guy in an Uber, so that's out of the question. And you just see how it just falls away. So making sure that we're improving this visibility. And then the whole overarching thing is don't forget about the parent. Check in with them. You know, I had a parent once who I walked in and she was like, he's fine. He's wonderful, actually. And he actually just graduated high school this year. I'm so proud. Yeah. All my babies are old now. Like they're 21, 16, graduating high school. I'm having a moment. But I walked in and she was like, I need you today. Okay, cool, man. And I mean, because if her mental health isn't okay, then she's not going to follow through with my dude. You know, she's going to snap at him. He's going to snap back. And then the whole house is in an uproar. And that was a fun house because there was like 6 kids, 3 dogs that were all like this big. The dogs, not the humans. Humans were like that big. So check in with those parents. Check in with them when they're off. And the big thing too is make sure that you're kind of labeling it. You know, hey, I see that you're looking, you know, whatever. And also on the flip side, label the good stuff too. Same family that we go from the garage to, hey, you know what? It's okay to ask for help. So she goes and asks for help. Cool, man. I see her a few times later, and one day I notice she's got lip gloss on and mascara. She had a chunk of her hair ripped out the year prior, and we were in tears. And she shows up, and I looked at her, and I was like, and we're on Zoom. So I'm not super creepy, I promise. Well, I'm kind of creepy. So I'm just like, hey. You look nice today. Did you wear some? And I know she's wearing it, but I want her to tell me. Oh yeah, you know, I had a little bit of extra time this morning, so I thought I would, you know, put makeup. Cool. I like it. So are things going well? Yeah, actually they are. I like that. So we start to see and we can start to kind of build in teaching them, okay, when I feel a certain way, I can do these things. And also, if I'm not feeling it, I can do these other things and maybe get back to this point. Because so often I see them just sitting in this, we'll go back to my Princess Bride, the pit of despair. And you don't really get out of that all the time. So I want to make sure that they don't fall into that pit and they don't get stuck there. So that's really what I do. I listen, I ask questions, I investigate, I hear the same stories a lot. I reframe, I rephrase. I try to teach them to identify their own emotions and physical states without it being super awkward and uncomfortable. Like it's not, I'm not going to tell you, okay, so your anesthesia today was, this is your motivating operation. I don't use that language. I'm actually quite terrible when it comes to data collection too. For instance, one of my favorite data collection pieces was, I had a family who I walked in and this was a family that they would leave. They would keep the garage door closed, push everybody into the car, open the garage door, drive, go to the thing, come back, close the garage door. Everybody gets out of the car. Because they were so terrified of their neighbors seeing them. Because their kid was, he was a rock star. He was a rock star. And I was like, this isn't okay. That's not healthy for you. And then I walked in one day, and they're like, hey, guess what? I was like, what? We bought real plates. I was like, you bought real plates? Yeah. like ones that could break and they're not broken. It was like, this is the best, the best. But it took a lot of building up those private events that, again, we kind of shy away from, like, but we can see, we can observe the little behaviors that go along with it. Okay, so I rambled for a while. So I'll leave you with two things. One, this is my absolute favorite quote, William James, Principal Psychology, this is ancient. And also, context, he's talking about social classes. I did not read it that way when I first read it when I was in high school because I was not thinking about social class. But I honed in on, and I'll just go ahead and read it. So, no more fiendish punishment could be devised, were such a thing physically possible, that one should be turned loose in society and remain absolutely unnoticed by all members thereof. If no one turned around when we entered, answered when we spoke, or minded what we did, but if every person we met cut us dead and acted as if we were non-existent, a kind of rage and impotent despair would long well up in us, from which the cruelest bodily torture would be a relief. So I want to let that sit for just a second, because again, a lot of our people are invisible. You know, there's a lot of invisible disabilities, even the ones that are visible, people aren't aware of, and they're scared of it. And that's not okay in my world. You know, I've lived in a lot of fear, and it's not cool. It's not productive.
Hello again. Here is the second of your two key words. Your second word is histories. H-I-S-T-O-R-I-E-S. Adult clients come with long learning histories.
Last thing, super cool things to check out because these people are super rad. Again, thanks for letting me talk. I'll go back to listening now. But people that are awesome, along with all the speakers here, Dr. Jeannie Golden, I'm kind of creepy sometimes. I've stalked her across ABBAs. She has a beautiful story with her daughter that if you check her out, it now spans their lifespan because she adopted her daughter when she was like 4, and now her daughter's in her 20s, and they talk together about what Jeannie, you know, the quote-unquote treatments that she was doing, and then her daughter gives her responses and like how this made her feel and everything. And it's super cool. Dr. Camille Kalou was a brilliant human. She's beautiful. She's wonderful. She does a lot of really cool work in trauma-informed care. Dr. Julie Sloviak has been doing some work in caregiver burnout that's now emerging. So super rad there. Also, again, if you don't have this beautiful blue book, I'm not getting paid for this. This is not a sponsored ad, I promise. Though I will say Awab is super cool. I love him. He was our intern. So check out the Noctitude Analysis. Gold Diamond, if you are curious, I have a collection of Gold Diamond because someone gave me their EBSCOhost once, and I was like, sweet, and just downloaded everything I could. So if you would like that, please hit me up. If you are interested in the history of behavior analysis, especially more on Gold Diamond, because there's a gap in knowledge of kind of where we came from as behavior analysts, please check out CLOT. So that's Constructional Approach for Animal Welfare and Training with Sean and Masa. And they're a brilliant duo who do a lot of work with animals and rescue shelters. But they also have this resource called the Bailey Interviews, where the Baileys actually interviewed a lot of the OG behavior analysts back in the day at the first few ABBAs. So if you want to go hear like James Holland, Thomas Gilbert, the Breelands, like these are names you may or may not know, go check those out. Gold Diamond's on there. So they're doing a lot of work to really build up that history to kind of see where our passions lie and why we're so passionate about helping humans, because we're kind of all in this together. So, and then Waller, that's the reference for the Waller article. And then my absolute shameless plug, check out ATBA. I think we're kind of cool. I talk nerdy to people. We talk about a variety of subjects. That's it. Camelon, thank you. And I'm going to stop talking now.
Thank you for listening to this adventure of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Check out the website, atypicalba.com, for more episodes, references, and to purchase CEUs. To stay up to date, like and follow us on social media. Just search Atypical Behavior Analyst. If you like the show, please rate and leave us a review. And if you want to support the show but don't need CEUs, you can help by clicking the Buy Us a Coffee link in the show notes. So until next time, listeners, grab your towel, keep exploring, and we'll see you in the fringes. Oh, we hope that you enjoyed that episode and had some great information to take back with you. So until our next time, here's a preview clip from episode 51. Enjoy, and we'll see you soon.
I was really kind of specifically interested in issues related to treatment fidelity. You know, one of the things that I'll say a lot is the research is pretty clear about what works. The challenge is, how do we get what works implemented? Because as you were saying, Kelly, that's kind of where the rubber hits the road. You know, probably most of us on the call, if we were presented with a case, we'd approach it the same way. We'd probably have a few of the similar hypotheses, but we'd know if we were going to produce the outcomes we need help from everyone, whether that's not just the child, the parents, caregivers, teachers, whoever it might be.